Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control, and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor, and you control the court system and the police departments. Then the fourth floor that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries, and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, well, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Adam Clayton Powell, for the first time, was defeated. Charles Rangel won in a very close election. Within a few years, Adam Clayton Powell would contract cancer and die.
If we must die, let us not die like hogs, end in some inglorious spot. What use is an extra year or two to the man who kills the time that God has given him?
Much of the story of Adam Clayton Powell is on display here in this anteroom of the Abyssinia Baptist Church. But there are many parts of the Adam Powell story that you cannot see hanging up on the walls, mainly the ironies in his life. Isn't it ironic that Adam Powell was such a loud voice that few people would listen to? Perhaps if his loud voice had been heeded on the question of police corruption, there may not have been a Knapp Commission. If his loud voice about government corruption had been heeded, there may not have been a Watergate. If his loud voice against hypocrisy on Capitol Hill had been heeded, perhaps Wayne Hayes and Tom Dodd and Earl Butz and Carl Albert and countless others might have not have been caught in such embarrassing situations. Adam Clayton Powell represents still another chapter in a long story of black militant fighters against oppression and injustice here in America. He wasn't perfect. He had his faults, but don't we all? The point is, he was a fighter. If he did play, He worked harder than he played. Most of all, he was a fighter.
As I know here, you're in trouble. Where it says about 30% are unemployed. That's why I'm working hard to get this surplus food here. Some of you say to me, well, I'm not like you. I'm not a congressman. I haven't got education. I haven't got work. But you're a human being. And you know what you've got? You've got in your hand the power to use your vote and to use even those few cents you get from welfare to spend them only where you want to spend them. A young slave boy stood one day before the greatest ruler of his day. And God said to Moses, what's in your hand? And Moses said, Lord, only I've got a stick, that's all. He said, well, let me use what's in your hand. And God used that slave boy with a stick in his hand to divide the Red Seas, march through a wilderness, bring water out of rocks, manna from heaven, and bring his people to freedom land. What's in your hand? What's in your hand? George Washington Carver, who was so frail that he was traded for a broken-down horse as a slave boy. And George Washington Carver, sitting in the science laboratory at Tuskegee, told me, he said, Dr. Powell, he said, I just go out on the field each morning at 5 o'clock, and I let God guide me. And I bring back these little things and work them over my laboratory, and that man did more to revolutionize the agricultural science of peanuts and of cotton and sweet potato than any other human being in the field of agricultural science. What's in your hand? Just let God use you, that's all. What's in your hand? I've got a string in my hand, that's all, and I'm flying a kite. And way up in the heavens, lightning strikes it, and I, Benjamin Franklin, discover for the first time the possibilities of electricity with a string in my hand. What's in your hand? Little hunchback sitting in a Roman jail. I haven't got anything in my hand but an old quill pen, but God says, write what I tell you to write. Paul Roof, I have run my race with patience. I've finished my course. I've kept the faith. And thought has laid up in me. What's in your hand, little boy? All I've got is a slingshot. And the enemies of my people are great and big and more numerous than we are. Well, little David, go down to the brook and pick out a few stones and come on back and close your eyes if you want to and pull back that slingshot and let it go. And David killed the biggest enemy, the leader of the giants, against his people, and his people became free, just letting God guide a stone in his hand. And a few years passed, and David is a king. And God says, what's in your hand? He said, I've got a harp in my hand. He said, well, David, play on your harp. And he played, the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. Maketh me to lie down in green pastures. Leadeth me beside still waters. Yea, though I walk through the valley in the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil. What's in your hand? What's in your hand? Man hanging on a cross? I've got two nails in my hand. Father, I stretch my hand to thee. No other help I know. If thou withdrawest thyself from me, whither shall I go? And that man, with two nails in his hand, spit history and hair, B.C. and A.D. And what's in your hand tonight, people of Cambridge? You've got God in your hand, and he'll let you win because he's on your side and one with God, always in the majority. So walk with him and talk with him and work with him and stick together and fight together. And with God's hand in your hand, the victory will be accomplished here sooner than you dreamed, sooner than you hoped, sooner than you prayed for, sooner than you imagined. Good night and God bless you.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005. And my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died, and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, we have a problem. She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years, signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I done signed and I done stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So
like,
you could just see $100,000, $600,000
deducted. So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here. Oh, man. He said, this woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor. Every tax check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. Mm-hmm. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was, my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie Dawson, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for 2 straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out the Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government, plus I had to pay my current taxes.
New taxes.
I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. Mm. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up, because my wife said, Steve, you finna be a major TV star. you're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. It's who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven. The radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back.
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So If you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad, Cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit, and it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect, no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, I hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Thank you.
an exclusive first look at the upcoming documentary, 7 a.m.
Because true economic science is a branch of military science. War and money go hand in hand. Most wars are fights so people can make more money, and war is money. That means what? That the European American is not about to prepare black children to compete with his children for control of the economic sector. It's not going to happen. So if black people want this science, we got to teach it, we got to study it, and we're going to have to make some mistakes in perfecting it because we're still babies in the water of global economic commerce. As African people, we are financially illiterate. So we should not be surprised that we're so economically backward because we were never taught how to be economically forward. Our education in America has not provided or prepared us to be able to compete with Europeans economically. The historically black college was designed to do what? Teach you how to work for white people. Public schools, charter schools, parochial schools, independent schools. What is the purpose of education in America for black children right now? To teach them how to make a living working for white people. But I don't want the kids coming to my school to be going to class thinking that I'm learning this so I can go and get paid by a white person. They're going to be empowered to start their own business. When they leave that school, they're going to go into business. And why do we need our people to be self-sufficient? Because when you're not self-sufficient, you can't speak your mind. One of the biggest reasons why black people have been so cowardly in the post-civil rights movement, not standing up for ourselves, standing up for our children, standing up against police brutality, we're scared to lose our jobs. We have to work. We got kids. I can't talk about the racism on my job. I might lose it. So the reason why we're not speaking our mind is because we don't have economic freedom. As Mr. Garvey said, Marcus Garvey said, that a solid racial program must be built on a solid economic foundation. Show me your economic condition, and I'll show you your political condition. The political economy of the black community rests on the premise that because they do not make their own money, they are enslaved to Europeans. And as a result of that, they will never be able to do what needs to be done to carve out a future for their children, because the hand that pays is also the hand that rules them.
Okay, today, the title of our podcast is How to Pay Off a $25,000 Debt with Hand Wealth and Word Wealth. And we got some stuff on our Blog Talk Scrolling Marquee program notes if you want to follow along on that. And let's see. But we want to start. But before we go to that, let's play. I'm trying to find a particular audio, but we'll be with that in a moment.
I'm Linda Mitchell's sister-in-law, and I want to thank some people here today, along with the other things I want to say. Linda was sick for a very long time, and Linda, without the help of Judge Pfeiffer and Randy and Nina and you too, Paul, she didn't always call you all those names. She called you everything but a child of God on occasion, Linda and Laura, Brett, Mr. Seward. Linda would have not been in that home that she held so dear had it not been for some of these white faces up here fighting like hell for her. Now, they helped her find funding that she didn't necessarily want to stay in her home, the only home the child knew. She loved that home. But it wasn't about bricks and mortar and marble. It was about her mama and daddy, and her daddy got up every day, and he went to work, and he had three jobs. And he bought that home, and they were proud of it. But Linda, God love her heart, toward the end of her illness, really believed that her mama and her daddy were coming back there someday to get her. And one day last May, they finally did. Those angels came and took her home, and she's not suffering anymore. But Linda couldn't have stayed there without the help that she had.
Chicken wings for that money, even though they was no good. But you do get something for your money. But when you put your money in the church bucket, what do you get back?
hope in a future after you die. And my position on that, if I have to die to experience heaven, I don't need that religion. Mm. Anyone who tells me that I should be content with accepting hell on earth when the white man has his heaven here, and the Chinese man has his heaven here, and the Arab and East Indian has his heaven here, and they're even building their heaven in my ghetto, and you're telling me I got to die in order to experience what they are getting right now? That's a religion I don't need, because that's a religion for servitude. And so we have to put the black church to task and ask them, what are you doing with our Jesus money? Let me tell you what they're doing with your Jesus money. Every black church in America has their money in a white bank. It is the white banks that are funding the regentrification ethnic cleansing movement. So all of us go to church. We put $3 million in the church coffers every Sunday. $3 million goes to a white bank every Sunday. And guess what they do on Monday? They take $3 million of black people's white Jesus money, and they give loans to white land developers and businesses and entrepreneurs to come into the ghetto where the church is located, buy up all the property, and force grandma out on the street homeless. Now, grandma been going to that church for 30 years. Grandma been giving that church $50 every Sunday. And lo and behold, grandma had to finally face the reality that it was your Jesus money that put your ass on the street.
I was listening to a YouTube video, well, watching a YouTube video and listening, sometime overnight. And the person who made the video said something very interesting that I want to incorporate in what we do here with this live stream, as well as our offline events. And the example that he used was that many people who go to prison, who are incarcerated, they've done studies on this. They have their vocabulary is low. So what he was saying is essentially, if you increase your vocabulary, that can bring more opportunity into your lives. And there's two people I'm thinking about right off the bat. Malcolm X. Malcolm X, when he was incarcerated, he basically, tremendously increased his vocabulary by reading and learning practically every word in a dictionary. That's a regular dictionary. And Free Ray Rick Ross, who some of you know, they've made movies about him and TV shows based on his life. He was given a life sentence. He couldn't read. When he was first incarcerated in prison, he could not read. And but while he was incarcerated, he learned how to read. Then he started reading law books. And he increased his vocabulary to the point where he got his life sentence overturned. So I've noticed there's a common denominator with I agree with the guy. Your vocabulary, along with skill set, can turn things around. So we're going to do everything we've talked about, but we're going to marry it up with these different type of wealth distinctions. Hand wealth. This is wealth that you create with your hands. Because when we're talking about building a tiny house or building a pet house, that's hand wealth. Matter of fact, two scriptures, Proverbs 31:31, read that one, and then Psalms 128:2. Once again, Psalms 128:2, check it out when you get a chance, and Proverbs 31:31. But we'll be talking about income vocabulary. Because people who have a seven-figure income, more than likely before they had the actual reality of the seven-figure income, $1 million a year or whatever it might be, they had a seven-figure vocabulary. So if you got a problem, I think some of the basic steps you need to take is increase your vocabulary, particularly whatever specific type of debt that you have. Anyway, this will make more sense as we actually do it and have people participate along with us. Let's see. Okay. It's Monday here, so and we've already got a project on deck for that, so and we're just trying to line up something else. All right, well, in any event, College Lemoyne Home College in Tennessee. I'm up to listening. If you can call in and share that with us. And let's see. While we're doing that, let's see. Neely Floor, we'll be right back after this.
Because I used to observe that a lot of those shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there looking for jobs, that's usually why we move, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do.
But we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be. Super highways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that sometimes you are right alongside of a railroad track. You see trains passing
that
as you are driving.
That is true.
Down a superhighway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build those shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off with things called unions, took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people that know how to build a house from scratch out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done. I'm old enough to remember when many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. They would get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some, all right? They were excellent, solid houses. They could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. But I've been in some of them. And there were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and big. Because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with their hands.
Mm-hmm. baby. I won't die.
Karnataka, southwest India, a land of temples, lush forests, but little electricity. With over 18,000 families lacking access to the grid, when the sun goes down, vast swathes of the region are shrouded in darkness. Solar energy has the potential to bring light to every home.
The people living in these areas are never going to have access to electricity. The only option for them to ever access power would be to use solar energy.
Set up 10 years ago, Selco Solar Energy is now working across the state, providing reliable and affordable energy to over 40,000 families. Selco's team of local technicians from Udupi are loading up a system to head off into the forest. Today, they're making a round trip to the Belsangadi region to bring light into the lives of another family. When they arrive, the technicians get straight to work, opening up the roof and finding the best spot for the solar panel.
Whenever we bring a solar system to a new site, we first select where to mount the panel. There are several restrictions. It must be south-facing and shadow-free. Then we consult with the customer where to keep the battery and where to install the lights.
This installation will power four lights. The solar panels produce a 12-volt, 40-watt charge, which is connected to a 60-amp-hour lead-acid battery, giving each light 4 hours life per day. A charge regulator is installed to help recharge the battery. After just 2 hours, the system is up and running, much to the delight of the proud new owners.
We're very happy with the new light. The children can now read with it, so we're very pleased.
The word is spreading. At this women's group, they're discussing the new technology. Selco's dealer explains how the system works and how to pay. There are over 5,000 self-help groups like this across Karnataka, with women clubbing together to take out small loans. Costing roughly $400 per unit, it's crucial that financing is thought through carefully.
As a group, this group has a greater chance of accessing bank funds because the bank also finds a greater security in the group borrowing because there is peer pressure to return the money back and ensure that the payments are done in time.
The meeting is being held at the home of Geeta Koragappa, who bought her system a year ago. She saves money by not having to buy kerosene and having time to work in the evenings.
After installing the solar light, I can save 40 or 50 rupees a month, which I use to pay for the loan for the system.
Another crucial factor is aftercare. Selco has a network of service centres where staff provide technical support to customers. Each centre has strict monthly targets and uses local agents.
The traditional problem with solar energy was systems were supplied in the areas and then it was not followed up with support. So what we have done is we have created these localized service centers within a distance of 100 to 150 kilometers from the customer's place, and these centers provide service to the individual customer.
Each service center has at least two technicians who tour the region and visit each installation every 3 months to service the system and make sure they're being used properly.
This system was installed 6 months ago, so it's scheduled for another service. First, we clean dust and burr droppings off the solar panel, then check float levels on the battery and top it up if needed. Then we clean the terminals and smear on Vaseline, check the current and the connections, and finally clean any insects off the lights.
Bringing light to the region has also brought benefit to local traders. These street hawkers in Bundapur are all using solar power. They're members of a light cooperative project started by a local NGO in partnership with Selco and run by local entrepreneurs. There are now over 70 stores here using solar light, and the scheme has been replicated in 13 places across the state.
Every morning, the batteries are charged using solar panels. So I take the batteries that are fully charged and come and meet the hawkers every evening at 4:30. They give me a 12 rupee fee, then they discharge the batteries in the evening, and I charge them all up again the next day. And so it goes on every day.
In recognition of the project's success and its contribution to sustainable development, Selco have been shortlisted for an Ashton Award. They now hope to reach the poorest sections of the community.
We intend to use the Ashton Award to create income generation activities to pay back the bank loans and make solar systems viable for them.
With over 46% of homes in India off the grid and many more with unreliable electricity, Selco is hoping to replicate the success of Karnataka across India.
Hi folks. In this video, I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second, and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas, and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land, okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash, This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is as large as it is and functional on the inside. Up there on my roof, you see my solar panels. That's a 350-watt solar system that provides all of my electricity needs for lights, TVs, water pumps, all miscellaneous gadget, laptop, TV, run my vacuum, and everything else off of a 350-watt system. That 350-watt system cost me under $3,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the power system of solar electricity, and I use propane. I have a propane tank in the back of the cabin, and I have a propane furnace, fridge, stove, and on-demand water heater, and those cost me just about $200 for an entire year. And we have cold winters here, folks. Under $200 for an entire year for all of my propane. That is the only utility bill I have. I do not pay for electricity. I do not pay for water because I drilled my own water well. Before I drilled my own water well, though, I hauled water in. But drilling a water well on a piece of property is not that hard. You can either do it yourself or hire somebody to do it. So I have no monthly utility bills. I have a house that's completely paid for. And I have freedom. A freedom that you can't get when you're under the pressure of a mortgage and utility bills. I want you to take just a minute and think about what you could do with your life if you had no house payments and no utility bills. And I'm telling you, it is completely possible. I'm not going to go into any details of how to get out of the house that you're in. You're going to have to figure that out and talk to some professionals for some help that way. All I'm here to do is tell you it's completely possible. Now, some of you are looking at the cabin and saying, yeah, but I couldn't possibly live in anything that small. This cabin was designed specifically for additions to be built on any of three sides. As you can see, the cabin has no windows on any of the three sides. There is a window in the back door glass. The sides are 14 by 14. The cabin was built to have shed additions built on all three sides. This cabin is 400 square feet approximately inside with 200 square foot footprint. When you add on additions, you could add on an additional 400 square feet on either side and off the back, giving you anywhere from 800 to 1,200 square feet. The great thing about building a small cabin to start out with, though, is it gives you a place to live when you build on your additions, and that way you can wait and live very cheaply without any house payments or utility bills, and then when you have the money, you can build on the additions to expand the cabin. That's very good for a single person or a young couple who don't have children because you don't need a whole lot of space to start off with. This way you can save for it, build on as you want to, have the additions, have the extra room if that's what you want. Now, I live full-time in this cabin. I live by myself, but my girlfriend comes up here on the weekends, and we stay together, and let me tell you, it's perfectly comfortable. We don't feel cramped at all, and we'd much rather have a small place like this. It takes a lot less money to heat. It takes a lot less money to cool. It's a lot easier to clean. It's just a fantastic home. Now, I'm not trying to push you into building a home exactly like mine. I'm just trying to provide you with some ideas. If you wanted to come up with different ideas, a different plan, that's just fine by me. But if you are interested in learning how to build a home like mine, I do have an ebook available and a printed book available called Simple Solar Homesteading. Go to www.simplesolarhomesteading.com. You can learn how to build a cabin like mine or at least get some great ideas for building your own home. Now, I want to repeat, I own my land. I have a house that I built for under $2,000. I have a solar electric system that I have for under $3,000. I use propane, which costs me under $200 a year. I have no house payments. I have no utility bills. If you want a life like this, it is very possible. You can stop listening to the media, and you can stop being put under society's pressures to live in the type of houses that everyone tells you you have to live in. You can live very inexpensively. And you can do this at any age, whether you're older or younger. If you're younger and you start in a place like this, imagine the amount of money that you would have to retire on, with no house payments, no utility bills, and freedom. Thank you for joining me, folks. Please watch the rest of my videos for more detailed information on each of the systems and a complete walkthrough of the cabin.
At Jiffy Lube, we care about cars. In fact, we're kind of obsessed. That's why we've been taking care of business with quick quality oil changes and service for over 40 years. And with things like our Carful Vehicle Review, where our experts will check, fill, clean, and inspect your vehicle, you'll know we'll care for your car like we care for our own. Jiffy Lube. Car more.
Visit JiffyLubeDC.com to find a Jiffy Lube service center near you.